All right, good morning. This is Bio 231, and it is November 5th. And we finished autonomic nervous system, but I want to go over just a couple things in the autonomic nervous system before we move on to the senses chapter, special senses. So let's see. Autonomic nervous system. Oh, yeah, something else I wanted to mention. Some people wanted to make sure, sent me emails requesting that they get that website that has the mock practicum on there. And so I didn't respond to your specific emails. I sent everybody an email through Blackboard. And hopefully you have the website. It's on there. It's in an announcement. If for some reason it's not on your particular page, let me know. Because this looks all like one class, but there's actually five different sections in here, and so I have five different sites in Blackboard that I have to update. And every once in a while something happens and one section doesn't get information. So hopefully everybody has the website. Okay. All right, so for the autonomic nervous system, what should you think of? Question would be, how many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? Yeah, there are two. What are their names? Sympathetic and parasympathetic, right? And in terms of motor outflow, there are significant differences in those two pathways. How does the parasympathetic nervous system get out of your central nervous system? What are the areas, just the structures? What part of the central nervous system issues parasympathetic innervation? As a matter of fact, we could call the parasympathetic nervous system something, something, in terms of outflow. What kind of outflow does it have? Yeah, because it leads through the brain, the cranium, and the sacrum. So it's cranial sacral outflow. As opposed to the sympathetic nervous system, what kind of outflow does it have? Thoracolumbar, right? Thoracolumbar. So it issues forth from two different parts of the central nervous system. And what else? How many nerves does it take to get from the central nervous system, whether it's the brain or spinal cord, it doesn't matter, to an effector organ? It requires two. And is that different than the somatic nervous system? Because how many nerves does it take for the somatic nervous system to get to the effector organ? It actually takes only one. One motor neuron will go all the way from the central nervous system to the effector in the somatic. And what's the effector? What is the effector in the somatic motor, in the somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle, that's right. Because somatic means voluntary, it means to skeletal muscles, because that's the only thing that you can really control in your body, is skeletal muscle. So that's one. But for every autonomic pathway, with the exception of one, which is what we're going to cover today, requires two neurons. What do we call those two neurons in an autonomic pathway? It doesn't matter if it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, there's always two. The first one, or the proximal neuron, is called the preganglionic neuron. And the second one, or the distal, is the postganglionic neuron. So there must be a ganglion in between them, right? There's a synapse between the pre- and postganglionic neuron. So let's see. Some similarities first between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. The preganglionic fiber. How would you talk about the preganglionic fiber in terms of the neurotransmitter that it uses at that synapse? Okay. The neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, so you're right about that. So what do we call neurons that use acetylcholine? Those are cholinergic, that's right. So all preganglionic fibers are cholinergic. It doesn't matter if it's parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system. Okay, and what about the structure, the speed of conduction? Can you relate the function of the preganglionic fiber to some structure that it has that's special compared to the postganglionic fiber? Somebody said that up there. I heard that. You're right. It is myelinated, right? It has Schwann cells around those axons, so it conducts via saltatory conduction very fast, as opposed to all postganglionic fibers are non-myelinated, and so they conduct impulses just by continuous conduction, which is relatively slow. So those are some similarities. Now let's think about some differences between in the preganglionic fibers and postganglionic fibers if we contrast the sympathetic with the parasympathetic. So let's start with the parasympathetic first. Is the preganglionic fiber relatively long or relatively short? Okay. For parasympathetic, it is relatively long because the parasympathetic preganglionic fiber goes all the way to the effector organ before it finds a ganglion. As opposed to the sympathetic nervous system, the preganglionic fiber is relatively short. Some of them only have to go to the sympathetic chain before they synapse. Okay. So then that means that the postganglionic fiber for the parasympathetic, this gets awfully wordy, but you have to really concentrate and think about this, right? The postganglionic fiber for the parasympathetic nervous system now is relatively long or relatively short? It's relatively short because it's all the ganglion is usually on the effector organ, so the length can even be microscopic. You can't see those nerve fibers at all. And they're non-myelinated, like we said. Now, what about for this postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system? Are they relatively long or relatively short? They're relatively long, in contrast to the parasympathetic nervous system, right? All right, now let's think in terms of the function of those fibers in terms of what neurotransmitters they use. So let's start again with the parasympathetic nervous system and the postganglionic fiber. What kind of neurotransmitter does it usually use? And how do we talk about that fiber? It is adrenergic, so it uses norepinephrine in most cases. I said parasympathetic. Okay, so it's the other way around. Parasympathetic, postganglionic, uses acetylcholine, so it is a cholinergic fiber. All right, now let's go to sympathetic. Postganglionic fiber uses norepinephrine, therefore it is an adrenergic neuron, right? Okay. Good. All right, so then we looked at some neuroanatomy, and that is the outflow of the sympathetic nervous system. How do sympathetic signals issue from the central nervous system? Brain or where, what levels of the spinal cord is what I'm looking for. It is sympathetic outflow is thoracolumbar, right? So it's going to leave the spinal cord only, not anything from the brain. So let's start with, let's see if I have a marker here, nice marker. That looks like, what does that look like? Spinal cord. Indeed, spinal cord. So here we have a nice spinal cord, of course, in the regions that from T1 to L2, you have a lateral horn right here because those are the only regions that have sympathetic outflow, and these are where the cell bodies of sympathetic nerves start from cell bodies in the lateral horn. How does this axon leave the central nervous system? So let's just say this is posterior here. This is anterior. This is just a typical view. How does this axon leave? Okay, so we got two roots. You only got two roots. And so this is the dorsal root. This is the dorsal root ganglion right here. And motor is always going to go out the ventral root. So this motor neuron comes out through here. Okay, and then of course it combines. What is this thing right here? When the two roots come together, that's the spinal nerve. So we got spinal nerve right here. And now don't forget, for the sympathetic nervous system, you have something that kind of reminds me of two auxiliary spinal cords, just for sympathetic outflow. What do we call those spinal cords that are on either side of the main spinal cord right here? The sympathetic chain ganglia. All right, so on either side are a sympathetic chain, and that goes up or down. And there could be cell bodies, there could be synapses in this region right here. So sympathetic nerves enter the sympathetic chain. How do they get into the sympathetic chain? Okay. From the spinal nerve, they cut out, right, and go into the sympathetic chain. So this pathway right here is a nerve, so we gotta name that nerve. What kind of color does it look like and why? It's white because it is myelinated, right? Because this preganglionic fiber is myelinated, so it looks white. So this is what we call what? The white ramus communicantes. So this is bringing signals into the sympathetic chain. And let's just say that the postganglionic fiber starts right here in the sympathetic chain because that's a ganglia. It's loaded with nerve cell bodies. And then that nerve carries signals back to the spinal nerve. So these signals are going in this direction and this direction. Now, what can you tell me about that neuron? The structure is different. It is gray because it's non-myelinated. So this is what we call what? The gray ramus communicantes back into the spinal nerve. And then these nerve impulses will either take this is what we call the dorsal ramus, right? Or posterior ramus. Or it's going to follow the anterior ramus. Okay, don't get roots and rami confused, right? Because in a ramus, signals are going which way? They're motor as well as sensory. They're mixed. Same thing for the dorsal ramus, right? Or posterior ramus. You could call it either one. These are always mixed. But what about a root? They're never mixed, right? So they're never mixed. All right, so far so good. We did this last time. But for the sympathetic nervous system, the ganglia that is functioning for a particular pathway might not be in the sympathetic chain. There are auxiliary ganglia that are in front of the vertebral column. So I'm just going to draw that in right here. We call these the prevertebral ganglia, or sometimes collateral ganglia. So how about if we call it prevertebral? Prevertebral ganglia. So sometimes a preganglionic fiber, all right, will go into the sympathetic chain and pass right through and synapse in the prevertebral ganglia. So what's the name of this nerve right here? That's just a splanchnic nerve, right? That's just a splanchnic nerve. So that's just a SPN, splanchnic nerve. You know what? I don't know if I like that name, prevertebral, because that sounds like paravertebral. Sometimes the sympathetic chain ganglia are called the paravertebral because they're on either side. So that P might be confusing with this prevertebral. Sometimes, let's just call it CG for collateral ganglia. There where the abbreviations are a little bit easier to follow. Okay. So I would draw that out a bunch of times. And then on this, what kind of information should you layer in your mind? Well, this fiber right here is what, cholinergic or adrenergic? It is cholinergic. And then this fiber is adrenergic. All right, and so this one is still cholinergic, and then this one going to some effector organ, this is going to be an adrenergic, right? Because this is the postganglionic, this is still the preganglionic. All right, so be able to draw that. That's not too hard to do. You could probably draw it in less than a minute. I bet you could do it. Okay. Yeah.
So like the signal leaves the collateral ganglia, and it goes
right here. Yeah, it goes to an effector organ someplace.
That
would be an adrenergic fiber. Yep. Because it's going to release norepinephrine on the effector organ. And one thing we didn't mention are what are the effector organs in the autonomic nervous system? Nice basic information. Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And somebody said involuntary organs, and you're right, which is what? Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Okay. So those are some things you should have on the tip of your tongue. Okay. What's this right here? Ah, that could be on the practicum today. I don't know. Ah, the great commissure is this right here and this right here, but that is really a hole with CSF in it. That's the central canal in the spinal cord. Okay, so cerebral spinal fluid is descending through the central canal to the conus medullaris of the spinal cord. Okay. All right, so that's it for sympathetic outflow. You saw it probably for the first time in the last lecture. It might have been a little confusing, but I think if you look at it a couple times, you should get a pretty clean picture of what that's all about. Okay. Okay. And if we have time left over from class today, maybe I could call somebody up to the board and you could draw it out. We could time you. We could have like a little competition how fast you could draw it out. I tell you what, I'm waking up. Who's got a watch that you can time me with? Anybody have a watch?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
I just got to get a pen that works. Ah, this one works pretty good. Okay, so if you can do it fast, then during the test, you should be able to figure it out pretty quickly, right? Even a practicum, you might have to know this stuff. Okay, so I'm ready. You tell me when.
Okay.
All right, so we got spinal cord. We got the, what, dorsal root? Dorsal root ganglia. We've got the ventral root. We got spinal nerve. Okay, we got the white ramus communicantes going to the sympathetic chain ganglia, and then we got the gray ramus communicantes, and then over here is the okay, I'm going to say ventral instead of anterior, and I'm going to say RA because it's mixed, and this right here is the dorsal RA, and then sometimes we actually have a nerve coming over to a collateral ganglia. And this is what we call, what, a splanchnic nerve. And that's going to go to some effector organ someplace. Did we miss anything? Not much. Okay. Oh, lateral horn. Okay, now. 1 minute.
50 seconds.
Okay. Okay, so that shouldn't be too complicated. Just a little bit of practice with that. And you guys can do good, 100% on the test. Okay, so I think I wanted to start right here because I want to show you a little exception to the rule where we always have a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber in an autonomic pathway. And on the slide above the board, we see that particular pathway. And it's probably not quite as nice a drawing as what I did on the board, but it's close. So you see the nice lateral horn right there in the spinal cord, the motor neuron, the sympathetic motor neuron comes out the ventral root into the spinal nerve, the white ramus communicantes, and you see it passing right through the sympathetic chain. And don't forget, sometimes preganglionic fibers arise or descend within the sympathetic chain to get to different levels, but this one passes right through the thoracic splanchnic nerve, and it goes all the way to the adrenal gland. And this is the deep part of the adrenal gland, so there are two main parts to the adrenal gland. There is the cortex, which is the superficial part. This is pointing to which part? The medulla, which is the deep part of the adrenal gland. So the adrenal gland has two main and different functions. The adrenal medulla has modified postganglionic cells. And these really aren't neurons because they don't transmit electrical impulses anywhere. They're stuck specifically and entirely within the adrenal medulla. But when they are stimulated with acetylcholine, right, because this is a preganglionic fiber, it's cholinergic, when these cells right here, which we call chromaffin cells that make up the adrenal medulla, when they're stimulated by acetylcholine neurotransmitter from the preganglionic fiber, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine. They don't send electrical signals. They release a chemical signal. And that chemical signal is picked up by a capillary and is distributed everywhere where the circulatory system goes, everywhere where the blood goes, which is what? Almost every place that's important in your body. And it's carrying that sympathetic signal in the form of epinephrine and norepinephrine. It's about 80% epinephrine, 20% norepinephrine. And that's going to stimulate a sympathetic response everywhere in your body, everywhere that the body goes. So that's just broadcasting sympathetic activity everywhere in your body. And epinephrine and norepinephrine in your blood have a longer lasting effect as well. An effect of norepinephrine on a target tissue might be fairly short-lived, might be a minute or two. But if you've ever been scared to death, for instance, you thought you were going to die, you probably are shaky for maybe a half hour, maybe even an hour afterwards because of the residual effects of epinephrine and norepinephrine in your circulatory system. Okay, so this epinephrine goes by another name, a more common name, but scientifically we don't use it very much. Does anybody know what the common name is for epinephrine? We call it adrenaline from the adrenal medulla. Okay, so that's where that name adrenaline comes from. That's really epinephrine. And norepinephrine could be called noradrenaline too, but that's usually not used very much in everyday language. Okay. So what I want you to appreciate is that signaling compounds or signaling chemicals or signaling molecules like norepinephrine sometimes act as a neurotransmitter, but it can also act as a hormone because a hormone is defined as a chemical messenger that gets secreted by a ductless gland. The adrenal medulla doesn't have a duct. It's not secreting epinephrine or norepinephrine into a duct which carries it someplace in your body. Okay? A endocrine gland secretes a hormone, and that hormone gets picked up by the circulatory system where it's delivered everywhere in your body. Okay, so the adrenal medulla is a ductless gland secreting these signaling molecules that are distributed by your cardiovascular system. So this is kind of atypical for the normal sympathetic outflow because you only have the preganglionic fiber and no true postganglionic fiber. So sometimes we can consider these signaling molecules right here neurohormones because they're picked up by the circulatory system and not just a neurotransmitter. So sometimes norepinephrine acts like a neurotransmitter, sometimes it acts like a neurohormone depending on what cell secretes it. Okay, who's got a question on that? And I, yes?
If the sympathetic nervous system slows down the digestive tract.
Right? Yep.
Okay.
Sometimes when you're so scared, you have a tremendous autonomic response that stimulates both the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system at the same time. And on some organs, that will cancel out. On other organs, one nervous system is going to win out over the other, or maybe it will just be total confusion at an organ. All right. So in that particular case, we're well beyond any kind of normal physiologic control, and so the response is kind of hard to predict what might happen when you're stimulated in an extreme condition like that.
So it's like Kay. Shock, right?
Like, for instance, yeah, if you go into shock, and you know, to tell you the truth, I'm not so sure that you can get the crap scared out of you. That's certainly a common term. I've certainly never witnessed that, but I could kind of see that happening. But and I've never seen anybody pee in their pants either, but that's a very common kind of conception that you would have, right? So, number one, I'd have to actually look scientifically and see if that's what happens. But, you know, it might be true. And in that case, I think the body is just so confused because there's such a tremendous outflow of autonomic activity, both sympathetic and parasympathetic, that it doesn't really know what to do at that point. Okay. So that's one way I would explain it. Yeah, so it's not a very scientific explanation, but that's the feel that I have for it. Okay? Okay. All right, so that's it for autonomic nervous system. Oh, almost. You have a number of nice questions. All right, we can maybe go over some of these questions. How would you describe the difference between the pre- and postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system? Right, in terms of neuroglia around them, the preganglionic are myelinated, postganglionic are non-myelinated. In terms of function, the preganglionic is a cholinergic neuron, the postganglionic is an adrenergic neuron. The preganglionic is relatively short, the postganglionic is relatively long, right? So that's how I would compare and contrast that. Why is the white ramus communicans white and the gray ramus gray? Because the white is myelinated. Right, okay, we won't answer the second part of that. I got carried away. Name the nerve that connects the sympathetic chain with a collateral or prevertebral ganglion. What do we call that? Splanchnic nerve. Yeah, it's going to have other subnames. We got three main splanchnic nerves, but you just got to know. Generally, that's what we call a splanchnic nerve. What is the general name for the chemicals, norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are secreted from the adrenal medulla? Okay, adrenaline and noradrenaline. I'm not sure that's exactly what I was after right here, because usually we would say norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter. I liked your answer, by the way, but maybe we need to layer some other things on there. Usually we consider norepinephrine a neurotransmitter. But in this particular case, it's not a neurotransmitter because it's not stimulating another neuron. It's acting as what? A hormone. right? So again, so the language breaks down just a little bit. You could say hormone, or if you want to be really precise, you could probably say neurohormone, because it's being secreted by a neuron. Yeah.
In regards to neurotransmitters, isn't that what usually creates the whole flight or flight response?
Absolutely. Okay, norepinephrine, when it's used as a neurotransmitter and even as a hormone, that's what's going to support your flight or fight response by doing what? Increasing heart rate, decreasing digestion, increasing ventilatory rate, diameter of airways in your lungs so that you can get air in and out of your lungs, dilation of your pupils so that you can see your environment, perceive threats around you, opening up blood vessels to skeletal muscles so that you can start using skeletal muscles without cramping or producing a lot of lactic acid, okay? Stimulating heart rate and contraction, if I didn't mention that one. So yeah, absolutely. Fight or flight response. All right? Are the quasi postganglionic cells of the adrenal medulla nerve cells or endocrine cells? Well, and when you ponder that question, you might say, well, I'm not sure I can really answer that because they're sort of acting like the postganglionic cell, but they're not carrying nerve impulses. So on the other hand, I kind of like to think of them as endocrine cells. So I don't know if you could really come up with an answer that everybody in the world could agree on. I guess I would kind of think that they're acting more like an endocrine cell. All right? But the best answer would be to say, well, they're neuroendocrine cells. And then nobody could argue with you, all right? And as a matter of fact, in a lot of classes, we don't teach the nervous system as a separate system and the endocrine system as a separate system, because there are a few parts of your body where they merge together, and this is the first example where you've seen what? The neuroendocrine system. Both of these systems are involved in controlling your bodies, but in just a little bit different ways. And they interface very nicely in some locations. Okay. All right, so we should actually think of what the nervous system and the endocrine system working together and being actually one control system in your body. What is the general name for the chemical norepinephrine which is secreted from the postganglionic sympathetic neuron? And I think there I was just looking for, okay, what is the general name for chemical which is secreted from the postganglionic sympathetic neuron? Well, that's just a neurotransmitter, right? That's just what that means. Okay. All right, so I think you got a pretty good feel for the autonomic nervous system. So, any questions? Okay, but we'll be back. Oh, what about Monday? Oh, I forgot. I was going to say we'll be back Monday if we have questions. But guess what? We're not going to be back Monday because it's a holiday. It's Veterans Day. Okay, so don't get too carried away over the weekend. Got to stay fresh for next week. All right, so we're done with Chapter 14 here. So we're going to move on to senses. All right, what chapter is that? It's probably 16, I think. Okay. We've got some pretty good pictures in the book on senses. Okay. So, senses, and we're just going to start out immediately with special senses, because we looked at some general senses already in the peripheral nervous system. So what are your special senses? Let's just name them first and then figure out why they're called special. So you've got taste, I like, smell, vision, hearing, that's four, equilibrium. And equilibrium has actually got two kinds. You've got equilibrium, which is a balance. You have a sense of balance when you're moving in a straight line. And then you also have another sense of balance when you start to spin. Yeah, I was going to say twist. We don't really twist much, but we can spin. Okay, so spin versus just linear acceleration. All right, so taste, we don't usually call that taste. We call that the gustatory sense, gustation with a G, gustation. And the sense of smell, we don't usually say smell, we say olfaction. So the sense of smell is olfaction. Vision is good, hearing is good. Static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium are all the special senses. Now, why are those special senses? They're special. Oh, well, I tell you what, let's go back to general. What's a general sense? It's, it's a sense that you have all over your body, right? So again, temperature. If you put an ice cube on your earlobe, you can tell, tip of your nose, back of your knee, your big toe, you can tell it's cold. That's a general sense. You have receptors for temperature all over your body. But a special sense has to do with a sense that you can only perceive in one or two locations in your body, and it's the result of a relatively complicated kind of organ. Like for vision, you need eyes, which are pretty complicated. We're going to look at that. For taste, complicated kind of organ, and you can't taste with your fingertips or elbow, kneecap, only with your tongue, right? So taste is special because of the limited places in your body where you have that perception. All right, so the same thing for hearing, only your ears, smell, only your nose, etc., etc., etc. Okay, so let's start with olfaction, and that is the sense of smell, right? And in order for you to sense chemicals by smell in the environment, they have to be airborne, and we call those odors, or sometimes we call these odorant molecules. These odorant molecules have to bind to receptors that are in nerves that are actually inside your nasal cavity. And when an odorant molecule binds to a receptor, that starts an action potential, which is how a nerve impulse is transmitted via olfactory nerves to your brain. And it gets in there via cranial nerve number 1, because it's the most anterior sense on your person, and it sends signals to the temporal lobe. We have about 7 primary odors, right? And there's a lot of discussion in literature about how many primary odors there are. We actually can see in 3 different colors, and then depending on the combination of 3 different colors, we can actually perceive millions of different colors. All right, so this is probably the best, most agreed upon chart, what the 7 primary different kinds of senses that we have, like flowery, etheric sense, musky sense, camphorous, sweaty, rotten, and stinging. And from that, we can perceive probably even more than 1 million different kinds of smell sensations, depending on which components of these primary senses are stimulated by receptors in our nasal cavity. Okay, so let's take a picture. No, let's take a look at a picture. Where did it go? Ah, here it is. All right, where do we... Oh, that's not smell at all, is it? Okay. Okay, here we go. So here we have the nose, the nasal cavity. So let's just look at this real quick. So we have nasal cavity, and you can see what your inferior nasal, middle nasal, your superior nasal concha right here. And this is part of the ethmoid bone. I can see what the crista galli up here that's attaching to the dura mater. And so here's the cribriform plate with all the olfactory foramina in it. So olfactory nerves actually go from your brain into your nasal cavity. And if we zoom into this region, this is what it looks like. So here is the epithelium that's underneath the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. And this is a really strange area in your body because this is the only area where neurons are actually dangling outside your body into the environment. In all other places, nerves are deep within, inside, underneath your integument, protected from whatever in the environment. So these nerves have kind of a rough life because they're just hanging out in space. They're protected a little bit by some mucus, perhaps, all right, but these nerve endings, these olfactory receptor cells don't have a very long life. I forget exactly how long on average they might last, maybe about 4 or 5 weeks, and then they die, and then they're replaced by other cells in the, like these support cells right here, which we call, or this basal cell right here, is a stem cell which can differentiate, grow, proliferate and differentiate into another basal cell and also a olfactory receptor cell. And I think that's really interesting because, for instance, I think when we talked about the spinal cord, we said if somebody ever damages their spinal cord, do they ever recover from that injury? No, and the primary reason is because nerve cells in the spinal cord don't know how to regenerate themselves or to proliferate. So when they die, they don't get replaced with anything. But here is an example of a nerve cell, right, from the basal cell that can regenerate new nerve cells. So that's a highly atypical kind of process. We don't know how that happens. I'm sure people are studying because we would like to be able to replace dead and damaged cells in the spinal cord, and then what could happen? somebody that's a paraplegic or quadriplegic, they'll have the function of their body back again. So it'd be really cool if somebody were to take some of these olfactory cells from a nose, transplant it to a spinal cord, have them grow and repopulate neurons in the spinal cord. Would that be cool? And then the person could walk around again. So that's a possibility. So that's something really interesting about the neurons within the nose. What might be one possible problem with that? Okay? If you take these neurons that are used to smelling and you put them in somebody's back, maybe they'll be able to smell with their spinal cord. I'm not sure. Okay, that's sort of an absurd kind of comment, but it's interesting to think about. Okay? Okay. And the other nice thing is, of course, that could be an autograft, right? If we take nerve cells from one part of somebody's body, stick it into another, do you have to worry about rejection? You know, in that particular case, you don't have to because it's an autograft, so that's really nice when we can find stem cells in different parts of the body, right? And the other nice thing is then we don't have to kill like other kinds of cells, like embryos or something, to get stem cells. So that solves a lot of ethical problems as well. All right, so this cell is a neuron. Can you recognize what kind of neuron is this right here? So what were the three main kinds of neurons? We had multipolar, we had unipolar, and this one is a bipolar. So we didn't see many bipolar neurons before, but here is the first chance that we get to see a true bipolar neuron. All right, and it sends its processes, filaments of the olfactory nerves go up into the olfactory bulb, and I'm sure you've seen the olfactory bulb, at least on sheep brains. The olfactory bulb in humans is not very prominent, all right, but it's a swelling because it contains these microcells, cell bodies of microcells that send signals all the way back via the olfactory tract to the temporal lobe. Okay, so these little filaments right here, these olfactory cilia have receptors, so an odorant molecule has to bind to these receptors, which then causes electrical activity in these bipolar cells, and that electrical activity goes all the way back to the brain for your perception. Okay, so that's the sense of smell. Now, when you look at this nasal cavity right here, getting a little long-winded on this, where do you have these olfactory cilia? What part of your nasal cavity? They're way up where? Are they on the inferior nasal concha? Middle nasal concha? Up here in the tip of your nose, or where are they? They're way up over here at the roof of the nasal cavity. So if you really wish to perceive an odor, what do you have to do to smell it? Can you just take a regular little breath so that air just kind of comes in right through here into your lungs? You actually have to do what? You have to force air up into this region right here where the receptors are. So if you really want to smell something, you have to, we say, what, sniff, right? You really have to get air up in that area. And the same thing for like dogs and cats, because what are they doing all the time? Yeah, they're really perfusing with air, right, these olfactory cilia right here. Okay, so that is the sense of olfaction. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about olfaction. Gustation is the sense of taste, right? And you can taste only with your tongue. All right, you have taste buds on your tongue. And let's take a look at some taste buds. Let's go back a couple slide. So here's a tongue, and if we look at the taste bud, here is a taste bud, so here is a cell. This is a gustatory receptor cell. In order for you to taste something, a molecule, a taste molecule, has to dissolve in saliva, and then it's got to move by diffusion through this little taste pore in the surface of your tongue and bind to receptors on these gustatory receptor cells, which then cause release of a neurotransmitter on this neuron, which carries information, taste information, to the brain. All right, so what do you see right here? Is this taste bud a large structure or a small structure, microscopic structure, and how do you know? I would say microscopic. I like that. How do you know that's a microscopic structure? Because you can see the cells on this illustration right here. And you can't see cells with your naked eye, right? There's just no way. They're way too small. You need a microscope to see cells. So a taste bud is a microscopic structure. It's not a structure if you stick your tongue out at somebody that they can see, or if you look in a mirror, it's not something you can see, which is kind of a little bit of a misconception, because if you look at the tongue right here, you see structures on it, and those structures are not taste buds, they are what we call papillae. And a papillae might contain thousands of these taste buds. Look at them all lined up on this micrograph over here. So a taste bud is what we taste with. It's a microscopic structure made up of these basal cells or supporting cells, as well as the taste cells. And papillae are the macroscopic or the gross structures that you can see on the tongue. And we have different kinds of papillae. We have small ones on the tip of your tongue. We call those fungiform. And the bigger ones in the back are what we call the circumvallate papillae. And they have different kinds of receptor cells in them. Usually we can taste sweet things with the tip of our tongue, but not bitter. But in the back, we can actually taste something like bitter and sour. All right, so they have different kinds of taste receptor cells, and even the papillae are different. Okay. Okay, so taste buds are composed of basal cells, supporting cells, and the gustatory receptor cells. A molecule has to bind to a receptor on that taste bud or on these receptor cells. And the primary taste sensations are sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami. And umami is the sense of deliciousness. All right, and so sweet, what molecule has to bind to a receptor cell in order for you to have the perception of sweetness? What kind of molecule would you say? A sugar molecule, like glucose, for instance. All right, sour is due to acid that's in our food. So hydrogen ions. You'll see what a hydrogen ion is when you get to a physiology class. All right, bitter is due to another kind of chemical compound like quinine, which is in tonic water. It has a bitter kind of flavor to it. And salty is due to salt, sodium chloride, table salt. And umami is due to various kinds of amino acids. Those are the building blocks of proteins. And the one that is most powerful and stimulating is glutamate or glutamic acid. Okay. And as you know, when you taste something like a margarita, what do you taste? You taste a little sweet because there's sugar in there. What else do you taste? You taste a little sour. Okay, because there's a little lemon in there, right? And you taste a little salt because there's some salt in there, right? So it's a very complicated thing, and your body just breaks down whatever you're tasting into these components, and you get the sense of everything. Okay. Okay. Let's move on to vision. All right, of course, that is a special sense. All right, so here is the exterior eye. So in terms of vision, we have some parts of the eye that are responsible for detecting light, but we actually have more parts of the eye that kind of function but don't have a direct function in detecting light, but they just help the light detection function properly, and you have structures that protect the eye. We call those accessory structures for vision. So for instance, we have eyebrows, which prevent debris from falling into the eye. That's what we call an accessory structure. We have eyelashes that do the same thing. And we have eyelids that protect the eye. That's an accessory structure. What's another name for an eyelid? Did you get into the eye yet in lab? It's got a funny name. Starts with a P. I don't know if it's on this slide or not. It's called a palpebra. Would be one. Palpebra, is that on this slide? Oh, palpebral fissure is. Ah. There is an opening, a fissure is what, just an opening in some tissue. So here's the superior palpebra, here's the inferior palpebra, and here's the fissure between them. Okay, so palpebra is an eyelid. And of course, these hairs in the eyebrows and eyelashes have sensory endings on them, so you can tell when something's brushing up against your face and when something brushes into an eyelash, what do? Without thinking, yeah, you blink, right, to protect your eye. Okay, there is a membrane that covers the outer surface of the eye, especially the white part of the eye right here. We call that the conjunctiva. Sorry, I had to think a second. All right, and the conjunctiva on the surface of the eye is continuous with the membrane on the inner surface of an eyelid. We call that the conjunctiva. And that is lubricated with tears from a lacrimal gland, which is about up in this region over here. So tears flow over the eyes and then out of your eye into your nasal cavity via the lacrimal canals. And you have a nice slide of that. Okay, so here you can, yeah, it says right here. Here's a sclera covered with conjunctiva. This little worm-like thing right here is just called a lacrimal caruncle in the medial angle or medial canthus of the eye. Here is the lateral angle or lateral canthus of the eye. So here you can see the conjunctiva on the inner surface of a palpebra going over the outer portion of the eye. And a couple glands. We have a tarsal gland in your upper eyelid, and that tarsal gland secretes not tears necessarily, but more of an oily kind of solution, right? And that oil forms a film over the most anterior part of the eye, which is what we call the cornea, and that prevents dehydration of the cornea because that oil acts as a permeability barrier. Okay, and here you can see, this is the first time you've actually seen a picture of it, but it was in your list in lab, the levator palpebrae superioris muscle that opens your eye, your upper palpebra, right, so that you can see. All right, on the slide over here on the right, you can see the lacrimal gland that produces tears, which lubricates and it flushes debris out of the eye. It flows over the surface of the eye and into the hole right here, which is what we call the lacrimal punctum, through the lacrimal canaliculus into the nasal lacrimal duct, and that empties into your nasal cavity. So for instance, when you're crying, that's why your nose runs, because they originate from the lacrimal gland all the way through your eye, not only just down your cheek, but into your nose as well. Okay. All right, so those are some accessory structures for the eye. Oh, a couple other accessory structures. When you look at something, sometimes you turn your head to look, but at other times, you just actually hold your head still, but move your eyeball around. And the muscles that move your eyeball around, these are skeletal muscles, we call these extrinsic eye muscles. And you have six of them. We've got a slide of the six extrinsic eye muscles. They move your eyeball around. So here are the six. You have four rectus muscles, a lateral, and then a medial, and then an inferior and a superior, and two oblique muscles. All right, which can also rotate your eye a little bit. And so that just helps focus light that is entering your eye to the most sensitive and best part of the retina, which is the photoreceptor layer inside the eye. Okay, so here's a table that shows what the motion is, what the innervation is. This is not an exam figure or anything in lab. You don't have to know the innervation of all those four muscles. Okay, so let me just look at our list right here. Eyebrows, eyelids, tarsal glands, conjunctiva, the lacrimal glands, extrinsic eye muscles. Yeah, I think we're doing pretty good. All right, now let's look at what's happening inside the eye per se. All right, so here we have a cross-section of the globe or eyeball. And what do we see? Well, let's talk about layers first. Layers are real important. So the outermost layer of the eye is this white part right here. That's what we call the sclera. And that has very tough connective tissue. Or sort of like the dura mater of your eye. It's very difficult to cut. And if you cut it in lab, you notice we probably don't even have any scissors that are sharp enough to cut it. Right? You need a nice sharp scalpel, and then you got to be careful you don't cut yourself. All right, so the sclera protects the eye, gives the eyeball its shape. Very, very tough. The next deepest layer, I don't want to lose my arrow, is the choroid. And that is what? Probably looks a little red right here. And the choroid contains blood vessels. That's the job of the choroid. Not very tough, but it contains blood vessels. And then the third layer is the photoreceptor area right here, which is what we call the retina. It's loaded with photoreceptor cells. And it typically does not contain blood vessels, because if there's a blood vessel in the retina, that's going to push away photoreceptor cells. And what do you need to see? You need a blood vessel to see or photoreceptor cells? You need photoreceptor cells. So if there are blood vessels in the retina, that's going to produce vision deficits. And actually, some people have gone blind because of that. And maybe I'll tell you about that in just a little bit. Okay, so the three layers, the sclera, the choroid, and the retina. All right, so those are the layers of the coats of the eye, and we have a couple chambers, a couple cavities inside the eye. This posterior segment, some books maybe call this the posterior cavity, but let's call this the posterior segment, and make sure you know what your lab instructor likes to call it, because it can go by different names at different times. Is filled with a jelly-like material, which we call vitreous humor. All right, a jello or jelly-like material. And so this posterior segment is the cavity that is posterior to the lens until it reaches the retina right here. That's the posterior segment. Anything in front or the space in front of the lens right here is what we call the anterior segment. So here is the lens that helps focus light on the retina. And anterior to the lens, we have the iris. The iris controls the amount of light that enters the eye because it can constrict and cause your pupil to get smaller, or it can dilate, causing your pupil to get larger so that more or less light enters the eye. This space, all right, between the lens and the iris, sometimes we call this the posterior cavity. And you might wonder, well, where is the anterior cavity at then? The anterior cavity is when we go through the pupil, which is a hole in the iris. So the pupil is not really a structure. It's just a foramen in the iris. We get to the anterior cavity, right? But it's still, what, part of the anterior segment. So the anterior segment has got an anterior cavity and a posterior cavity. And both of those cavities are filled with a different kind of substance compared to the posterior segment over here. The anterior segment has something called aqueous humor, which is basically just water, but it has electrolytes in it as well. Okay, it's a very watery kind of substance. And then that takes us to the most anterior part of the eye right here. That's the cornea. And of course, the cornea should be absolutely transparent and clear, so it lets light in. The lens should be absolutely transparent and clear. All right, and the aqueous humor should be clear. It shouldn't have fungal infections or red blood cells in there or anything like that. It should be clear. And, of course, the vitreous humor should be very transparent and clear as well, because it just transmits light. Now, unfortunately, as we get older, these things do get cloudy. All right, so we do lose the vision. Sometimes the lens can become opaque. That's what we call a cataract. All right, and as we get older, debris can fill up in this posterior segment right here, and when somebody's looking around in the world, they might actually see things floating in front of their vision. Those are what we just call floaters. Those could be accumulations of red blood cells, maybe white blood cells, or even filaments of proteins that get trapped in the vitreous humor. And a lot of people have tried to do something about that by sucking out the vitreous humor and putting something back in there, and all those experiments have failed miserably. Okay, so when you have floaters, you just have them, and that's just something you learn to live with, at least as far as we know to date. On the surface of the cornea, right over here, you have a lot of pain nerve endings. And if you damage the cornea, supposedly that's the most exquisite sense of pain that you can experience in your lifetime. Thank goodness I haven't experienced that, so I can't comment for sure, but it can be damaged. If you're working on your car, building a swing set for your kids or something, and something flies off of a wrench, like a screw breaks or something, and hits the cornea, that damages the cornea, and you certainly would wish that that had never happened because the pain is just so extreme. Also, way back when I was growing up, there was a new invention for glasses, and it was called a contact lens. Okay? And back then, contact lenses were hard plastic, and they're still available to some people with certain kinds of problems with their vision. But today, we don't have hard contact lenses. Usually, we have gas-permeable lenses. Gas-permeable lenses are very nice because the cornea right here is living tissue. It needs oxygen, but there are no blood vessels in it, so it gets oxygen from the atmosphere. So if you put a hard contact lens over it, it blocks the oxygen getting to the cornea and it starts to die. And of course, those nerve endings start to die as well. And they object to that, right? They start sending pain signals to the eye. And people, every once in a while, would forget to take their contact lenses out overnight, fall asleep with them in their eyes, And that's when the cornea would be damaged. They'd wake up in the morning feeling like somebody was taking a red-hot poker and sticking it in their eyes. Very miserable. Did that ever happen to anybody in here? Oh, one person? I'm sorry that that happened. But the pain is so bad, you would probably never, ever do it again. Did you ever do it again? You do it all the time. Okay, well, yeah, don't forget. Maybe try gas-permeable lenses. Okay, well, now I know two people that actually have done it more than one time. Okay, but usually the pain is so bad you wouldn't ever think of doing it a second time. Okay, so that's the cornea. So we got the cornea. We've got the anterior cavity of the anterior segment. We've got the iris. Then we have the posterior cavity of the anterior segment. We've got the lens, and then we've got the posterior segment right here filled with vitreous humor. All right, so don't forget, this iris is going to constrict or dilate depending on ambient light conditions. So it's moving around all the time. Yeah?
What happens to the eye when people weld and they don't wear
their... Oh, yeah, we can talk about that. We can talk about that in just a little bit, but I'll remember to say something about that. Okay, so here is that iris. Don't forget, under normal circumstances, what's it doing all the time? It's adjusting for light, right? It's dilating, constricting, depending on where you're looking. All right, this lens right here is important because if there is a point in space way out over here, light is coming from this point, but it is diverging. It's moving at an angle from that point. And in order to see that point nice and sharp, when that light reaches the retina way back over here, that light that is diverging has to be bent back so that it forms a nice perfect single point on the retina. Okay, so that's in focus. That will give you a nice sharp image in your mind to see. And if it doesn't focus as a sharp point, okay, we say it's out of focus, and how does it look then if it's out of focus? It looks blurry. And you've maybe have taken some pictures with a camera that were out of focus. They just look blurry. And that used to be a real hassle with cameras, and like when I was growing up, because you'd have to sit there and focus the lens. Today you don't have to focus the lens. It does it automatically, electronically. Okay, but your eye has to focus as well. So that's one of the, that's part of the job of this lens right here. The lens has to change shape in order to focus an image on the retina. So sometimes it is very thin, sometimes it is very thick. So there is a muscle that can apply tension to the lens. We call that the ciliary muscle or ciliary body. The ciliary body is connected to the lens via these suspensory ligaments. Can you see these little tiny ligaments right in here? The suspensory ligaments. So the lens changes shape. That process of changing the shape of the lens is what we call accommodation. So I got to make sure I got that on your list. Okay, accommodation is due to the action of the ciliary body applying tension to the lens right here. But accommodation really has a special kind of meaning to it. Not just focusing day in and day out, but a special kind. So to appreciate accommodation, take your hand and stick it in front of your face, extend your hand out. Now, look at your fingertips. Focus on your fingertips. Don't look at the back of the room. So your fingertips are nice and focused, but what about the background? Is it in focus?
No.
It's not in focus. It's blurry. All right, now keep your hand there. Look at the room behind your fingers. All right, what happened to your fingers? It's switched. Now they're blurry. All right, so you can only focus on one distance from you at a time. You can't focus the whole world at one time. So you can't read a book and drive down the road at the same time, okay, because not everything is going to be in focus. So shifting the distance of focus is what we call accommodation. So what allows you to change distance is what? The shape of the lens allows you to accommodate. So this lens has to change shape. So the ciliary body has to put more or less tension on it. Okay. Now that's something else that's interesting. As we get older, guess what happens? This lens gets stiffer. Okay. And so when you change your attention from far away to close up, it takes longer for that to happen. All right, so if you're reading something and then look up, everything's going to be blurry for about a second or two, and then it's going to pop into focus. That's something that happens as we get older. So I kind of relate this to everyday experiences that we have. Like if you ever see somebody driving down the 405 freeway and they're going 25 miles an hour, okay, guess what kind of person that is? Usually it's an elderly person, right? And one of the reasons is why? Because they can hardly see anymore. So if you're, say, in your 70s or 80s, what is one thing you're really worried about? Okay, speeding, right? Because if you get a speeding ticket and you're in your 70s or 80s, if you're an octogenarian, what's going to happen to your driver's license? Yeah, they're going to yank it from you, right? So if you're an octogenarian driving down the freeway, you're really concerned about how fast you're going. So what are you looking at? Because you don't want to get a speeding ticket. What are you looking at? Your speedometer. Where's your speedometer? Really close. It's right in front of your face. So you're looking at your speedometer and you go, oh, I'm only going 25 miles an hour. And so you feel relieved, right? But then you go, oh, I don't want to be in the freeway. I don't want to miss my exit. So I better look where? Not at my speedometer, but down the freeway to see where my exit is. And so somebody looks up from the speedometer to down the freeway, and what do you see? It's all blurry. Okay, because you haven't accommodated yet. So 1001, 1002, the image pops into focus and you can see your exit down there. So now how are you feeling? Good, right? Because you haven't missed your exit. But then you got another thought right away. What's the other thought that pops back into your mind? Am I speeding? Ah, I don't want to speed. I don't want to get a ticket. So you look from down the road to your speedometer and what do you see? Nothing. It's blurry. 1001, 1002, the speedometer pops into focus. 26 miles an hour. You feel good. But now what are you worried about? I don't want to miss my exit. So you look down the road and what do you see? Nothing. Okay, it's just blurry until you can accommodate and see your exit. So I guess this is just a public service announcement. When you see those viejitos driving out there, just be kind and nice to them and stay out of their way. Okay, because they just can't see. And that's going to happen to all of us if we're lucky enough. Okay, so that's accommodation due to the ciliary body, suspensory ligaments, and the lens. Okay, so in order to focus light rays that are divergent, that are separating, to get them to converge, to bend back, to focus right on the retina, you need some kind of curved surface to move, to bend those light rays back. And the lens certainly does that, but do you see anything else that's highly curved that light goes through? That actually looks like a lens. Is there, how about, what does this look like right here? A lot of curvature in the cornea. And as a matter of fact, the cornea has more focusing power than the lens does. The most important element of the eye that focuses light on the retina really is the cornea. The job of the lens is to do what? Make small adjustments so that you can accommodate. But the major adjustments are due to the cornea right here because it really is acting like a lens. And that's interesting. Some people realize that. And they said, you know what? I bet we could correct for vision problems by changing the shape of the cornea right here using a laser. And we could look at the distance of the cornea to the retina, the shape of the retina, the shape of the cornea, and reshape the cornea so that it perfectly focuses light on the retina using a laser. And that's very common today. That's called the LASIK procedure, right? And it's really kind of a nice procedure because when you're going to surgerize somebody's eye, would you like to surgerize something that's very superficial, easy to get to, or a deep structure inside the eye? Superficial. So that laser surgery inherently is pretty simple to do because you don't have to dig around in somebody's eye. And, huh? And it heals pretty quick. Yeah, it heals very quick. And most times it works very well. But I don't recommend it for cosmetic reasons because things can go wrong. All right. But if you have a need to correct your vision, say if your vision is so poor you can't even find your glasses in the morning, then a LASIK procedure is beautiful. It will change your life, right? You have really nice normal vision. One of the downsides is when you get LASIK, okay, that's for that one point in time in your life. What can you tell me about your vision over your lifetime? It keeps changing all the time, right? So LASIK works for that one point in your life. Another downside is as you get older, okay, say, and this is happening to me right now, I've got good far vision. It's corrected with my glasses right here. But if I want to read something, right, what do I have to do? I have to hold it close, but it actually gets worse as I bring it closer. I actually have to take my faraway glasses off, and now my close vision is really good. So that's just one thing about the optics of the eye. As you get older, okay, there's a trade-off between far vision and near vision. Okay, so that if you correct for your far vision, your near vision gets worse when that happens. Okay, and I can correct for that very easily just by taking my glasses off. But now I'll say, if I get a LASIK procedure, which now corrects my far vision and I can see things very far, nice and clear with my glasses off, and I start to read something and it's blurry, what can I do? I can't take my glasses off anymore because it's what? A permanent change in my cornea. So now what do I need to have in order to see something up close? Now I need reading glasses. Okay? And I think physicians that do this technique tell you about that, but I know some people that were kind of fooled or misunderstood that got a LASIK procedure when they were middle age, and they walked out of the doctor's office and they could just see things beautifully crystal clear, and then they got a cell phone call, so they pick up their cell phone out of their pocket and look at it, and they couldn't see their cell phone. And they can't use their cell phone without getting, what, reading glasses to see. All right, so it's a trade-off between those two different kinds of vision. The other thing, reason why I guess I don't like the LASIK procedure very much is because I think it's really nice to wear glasses. Because what do you have? You have a nice protection. They have a nice hard barrier protecting your eyes because the cornea is very delicate. It's easily perforated with any kind of object that hits your eye right here if your eyelids aren't fast enough to catch it. And if the cornea is perforated, of course you're going to feel that exquisite pain, but there's something much worse that will happen than that painful situation. Right? When the cornea is perforated, what can you tell me about the fluid in this anterior segment right here? What is that? It's aqueous humor. It's just going to dribble right outside of the eye. It's just going to run down your face like a tear or something. And now the cornea can touch the iris, and the iris can touch the lens and the ciliary body right here. And these structures are all very sticky, and no one has ever figured out a way how to unstick the cornea from an iris or from a cornea once they get stuck together by an accident or surgery or whatever. And so I guess you should think of, what does the iris do all the time? Is it just sitting there? It's moving around, right? And what about the ciliary muscle and the lens? Is it just sitting there day in and day out? No, it's moving around too all the time. But if they get stuck together, what about that motion? Can't move. So you got some really terrible vision deficits after that. Your vision will never be anywhere close to normal. Okay, so that's why I like glasses and maybe not so much that LASIK procedure. So for strictly cosmetic reasons, I'm not a really big fan. Okay, but if you do have LASIK and you're worried about perforating your cornea, of course you should have some glasses around whenever you're doing anything sort of dangerous. Yeah. Any downfall, as long as you don't leave them in too long a period of time to where you damage the cornea because they're not getting oxygen. Yeah, so I don't know, as long as you keep them clean, okay, but if you place infected contacts on your eyes will get infections, or if there's debris on it, it could scratch the cornea. So as long as you take care of your contacts and wear them properly, there's no downside as far as I know. Like, there's no predisposition to cancer or cataracts or anything like that. As a matter of fact, it might help with cataracts because some of the energy and light can produce cataracts, and some of that energy might be actually filtered out by plastic. That's another reason to wear glasses too, because plastic absorbs ultraviolet light, and that's what produces cataracts. Yeah.
Can't you just do LASIK on one eye? That way you can have your far and near.
I've heard that that's possible to have. So usually a LASIK procedure is done bilaterally, the same correction on both eyes. But it's been recommended to numerous people I know, just do LASIK on one eye to have far vision and then reading vision in your other eye. But I've never known anybody to live with that. But if you know somebody that does, I'd like to talk to them to see if that's a successful way. But I've probably known 50 people to get LASIK, and they could never figure out how to live their life with two different visions and different eyes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, if you got contact lenses in your eye, you got to treat it nicely. You don't want to get folded up. You don't want dust underneath it and stuff like that, for sure. because you could scratch the cornea.
Can the damage sclera as well?
Yeah, probably, but that's not such a big deal. It's a cornea that's very delicate because it's transparent, and you don't ever want to change the transparency of that cornea right there. Okay? Wait a second. When do we stop? We start 10:30. Oh, so we've got to be done in a couple minutes. Okay. So some more stuff about the eye. Here is the optic nerve, right, that is going to attach to the retina because the retinal cells, the rod and cone cells, are going to cause electrical signals in the optic nerve, which is going to take vision signals to the brain. And where the optic nerve attaches to the retina, there are no photoreceptor cells right there. And so we call that the optic disc, but functionally that produces a blind spot. So in that part of your visual field, you actually have a blind spot. You can't see anything in that area. And I don't know if in lab, if you were able to find your blind spot, but I can show you how to find it on the board if you come up after class or during office hours or something. I can put a diagram on the board, and with one eye, you have to cover one eye. With that diagram, if you focus on one area, there's going to be a blind spot someplace else, and I can put my hand or my fingertip in that area, and it's just going to disappear because you have a blind spot. But your brain is so good at filling in that information day in and day out that you don't see the blind spot in daily activities anymore. You have to do a special little technique to see it. So that's due to this optic disc. Okay, so that I think covers the eye pretty well. All right, but I did say there were times there were people that had development of blood vessels in their retina. Okay, let's just cover that real quick. All right, we can move on to a couple more slides. I think we have time. But let me tell you about a certain class of individuals that had blood vessels growing in their retinas. So we said that, how does the cornea here get oxygen? Just from the air, right? So oxygen can diffuse into the cornea, and oxygen can diffuse through the aqueous humor, and even some extent through the lens and around these suspensory ligaments into the vitreous humor, and it can diffuse to the retina. And it's that oxygen can stimulate the growth of blood vessels into the retina. Now, what kind of individuals experience a high level of oxygen in the air that they're breathing? Scuba divers, maybe. It's a higher partial pressure. But you don't live underwater for very long, but maybe some professional divers might live. Or high altitude, decreased oxygen. But there's one kind of individual that experiences very high oxygen 24 hours a day. And that would be a premature baby that's born premature. Where are they placed? In an incubator, and one of the reasons is because a premature baby can't regulate their body temperature very well yet. And their lungs aren't developed, so they have trouble breathing, getting in oxygen, so we'd like to increase the oxygen inside of an incubator for premature babies. Well, way back when we first started using incubators, we would say, oh, well, this individual has really poor lung function. Let's just put him in 100% oxygen atmosphere. What the heck? Okay. Well, what happened? Oxygen diffused through the cornea, through the lens, to the retina, and it stimulated the growth of blood vessels in the choroid into the retina, producing blindness. Okay, really unfortunate. And of course, you couldn't tell for what, years and years, because you can't talk to an infant in the language, right? That's called retinopathy of prematurity. And so now, what do? We know that. Okay, we don't put in 100% oxygen. We try to make the oxygen as low as possible to prevent the stimulation of blood vessels into the retina, but still what? Having the patient have enough oxygen so that they can develop normally. So that takes some judgment there, right? That's what education is all about, developing the right kind of judgment. So that just kind of underscores, where do you find blood vessels? What layer of the eye? The choroid, not the retina, right? Because that's going to block out photoreceptor cells. I don't think I want to spend a lot of time on that slide right there. Or this one. These are all good slides, but here you can see the iris. No. This is the ciliary. Yeah, this is the ciliary muscle. All right, and here is the lens. Okay, so what's that process of when the ciliary body puts more or less tension on the lens, changing its shape so that you can shift your focus from far away to close up.
Accommodation,
right? That's called accommodation. All right, so here is a nice shot of the retina. And this is the pathway of light coming in the eye, going to the posterior part of the eye. This is the most sensitive part of the eye right here. So this layer is the retina. And these are the photoreceptor cells, which are deep in the retina. These are not the cells that light hits first. And you can see that there are two different kinds of shapes on these cells. There are some that look like rods and some that look like cones. So guess what we call these that look like rods? Rod cells. And these are cone cells. They have two different functions. And I'll just describe the functions really quick for you. The rod cells allow you to see in very dim light conditions. So they're highly sensitive for looking at things in darkness. But the trade-off is you can't see colors. These rod cells don't give you any color information. So they work only in shades of gray or black and white. That's the job of the rod cell. The cones, all right, on the other hand, allow you to see in color. So, but the trade-off there is that you need bright light to see in color. So if you want to appreciate color, you should go like outside in sunlight, because then you can really appreciate. But if we turn all the lights off in the room, or if you're out at night and the moon, maybe you have a half of a moon shining light on everything, very dim, you can still see, but you can't see in color. Okay, so that's the big difference between the rods and cones. Another big difference is that the rod cells allow you to see general shapes and large structures. It doesn't allow you to see things in high resolution, high definition. It's the cone cells, because of their structure and how they're populated in the retina, allow you to see fine detail. So the cones are HD. The rods are just, you know, 512p. Okay, low resolution. Cones are high resolution. Yeah.
So cone cells allow you to see color and
rods black and white, cones color. Okay. Also, where they're populated is different as well. In the posterior pole of the eye, where light comes right in to the back of the eye, actually I want to go back a slide and take a look or two. Light comes in and goes right to the posterior pole. There's a special part of the retina that's specialized for your best vision. It gives you color vision and the best resolution. What kind of cells give you the best resolution in color? The cone cells. So in this area of the retina, it's populated with 100% cone cells. And that's called the macula lutea. And even in the very center of the macula lutea, there's what we call the fovea centralis. It has 100% cone cells in there. And that's what the extrinsic eye muscles are always doing, letting light that you're concentrating on fall right on the fovea centralis, right behind the lens over here. And some people, unfortunately, have a degeneration of cells in this area, and that puts a hole in their vision where? Right smack in the middle. They can still see peripherally pretty well, right? But right in their central vision, there are holes. That's called, anybody know what that? That's macular degeneration. And that's really unfortunate, really obnoxious, because when you look at something, how do you look at something?
Straight at it,
right? And people with macular degeneration can't look at something straight on. They have to look, what, to the side to look at something. Okay, but they can't see in color. They can't see fine detail because of the rod cells in your peripheral vision. So rod cells populate peripheral vision. Cone cells populate central vision. All right, well, that's it for today. And remind me where to start a week from today. God, I'll never remember.
Yeah.